Are is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Celeste Quinn. This afternoon on the program, the story of a Sudanese woman, Minde Nazaire, who was kidnapped and sold into slavery in 1994. 4 years ago, she escaped. Minde Nazaire and her family lived in a remote area of Sudan. They lived in the Nuba Mountains in south-central Sudan. The people of her village were hunters and farmers. They raised cattle. Most of the people were Muslims. One night in the spring of 1994, the village where she and her family lived was raided. The village was burned. Many people were killed. The children were rounded up and taken away. Minde Nazaire was about 12, although she is unsure because the Nuba do not keep records of birth dates. However old she was, she says on that cold spring night, her wonderful, happy childhood ended, and her life as a slave began. Minde Nazaire and journalist Damian Lewis are our guests this afternoon. Together, they have written a book about the years Minde Nazaire was enslaved. The title of the book is Slave, My True Story. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. Minde Nazaire is about 23 years old. She was granted political asylum by the British government last year. She speaks frequently about her slavery experience to people interested in human rights. Damian Lewis is a British journalist who has reported extensively on Sudan. The book, Slave, My True Story, is published by Public Affairs Books. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Good afternoon. Thanks to the both of you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Minde, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, it's all right.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much. Well, tell us, both of you, tell us about the day you met one another.
Actually, I met Damien the day I escaped.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I met Damien in a solicitor's office. He was there.
Yeah, basically, Minde escaped on the 11th of September 2000, and she had been brought to London to work in the house of a diplomat, a Sudanese diplomat in London. And I was asked to help with her rescue when Sudanese exiles living in London found out she was there and decided to effect her escape. So I actually met her the day she ran away from that house.
Yeah. What was that day like, Minde?
Sorry?
What was that day like? That's up to September 11th, 2000. What was that day like for you?
Oh, actually, that day is for me is, I don't know, it's mixed feeling. I'm like quite frightened about escaping, and it's very hard. It's very tough day for me because how can I manage to escape and how I'm going to do that? It's very tough. It's very tough day for me.
Yeah. One of the chapters in this book is called Fear of Freedom. What was it like adjusting to freedom?
The freedom actually, basically, is very, 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 very precious for me because after that such long time I've been in captivity, when I had my freedom, I found it is quite hard to deal with because when I was in slavery, I haven't taken my own decision. I've been always as a machine, they turn me on to do things for them. But when I had my freedom, I had to be independent and to take my own responsibility. I really found it is very, very hard to adjust to.
Hmm. How did the two of you come to write this book? Damian, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, it was actually serendipity. A British publisher was at a dinner party in London, And a very good friend of mine, Mendes, was there talking about Mendes' story. And the longer she talked, the more the British publisher was just absolutely amazed that slavery could be happening today, and that it had not only just happened in Africa, but also in London. And at the end of the dinner party, she came up to our friend and said, have the two people ever thought about writing this girl's story? Because it's the most extraordinary thing I've ever heard. And so the publisher came to us, and I remember Mendes' initial reaction was, who on earth would want to read about the story? But the rest is history, as they say, because it's a very compelling story, but a shocking one, too.
Yes, it is so shocking. And yet, you're right, it is so compelling. And Mendes, I wish you a very long and wonderful, happy life. I'm so pleased to be speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
What happened to you in the first days after being stolen from your family?
I can't hear.
I'm sorry. I'm interested in having you tell our listeners what happened to you after you were taken from your village, after you were stolen from your family.
Actually, after being separated from my parents, I've been taken by the raiders, the people who attacked my village. And from there, he took me to a place called Dilling, and they put us in a camp. And from the camp, we stayed for several days. And from there, we've been taken by some people to Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan.
Yeah. What was life like there for you in Khartoum?
The life actually is very, very hard for me. It's really, really hard. I haven't been done this sort of things since I've been in Nuba Mountain. I really had a very hard time and very tough time.
Yeah, and the woman who you called master, she was fearsome. Rahab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rahab, she's so cruel to me. She's really, really, really cruel to me, and she treated me very, very bad. Even I don't know what's the right word to use it here, and she really treated me just terribly bad.
Yeah.
The way Mendes has described it to a lot of people is, if you can imagine being treated worse than an animal, because she says, you know, animals, pets, in the West, they get stroked and they get cared for and they get some affection and some attention. Mm-hmm. She had none of that. Not only was she beaten and abused and destroyed as a human being, but she had not even the basic affection that a pet animal would be given.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It would be a couple of years before you realized you had been sold as a slave, and this is a telling episode, I think, in the book. Damien, mm-hmm. You can also jump in here as well. You overheard a conversation that Rahab had with some guests of hers,
yeah,
where she sung your praises, but yet she treated you so cruelly.
Yeah. And actually she was so proud of having her as a slave in her house. She's showing off to her friends. And she always, her friend won't ask her, oh, the house is very clean, everything is tidy, and she, like, so proud of having me. She said, if you want to get her, you can get her, and she said, like I'm her, like she's my owner, and she really acting in very, very, very proud way for her, of having me in her house and doing all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
That was the first time that Mendes actually heard her master. I mean, Mendes a black African, and her master was an Arab from northern Sudan. And that was the first time she actually heard the woman she had to call master telling her friends, you know, I paid for this girl, I own her, and if you want to go and buy one too, you know, this is how much they cost, they're easy to get, why don't you go and get one? You know, it's wonderful, look how clean they keep the house. Almost like a sort of, you know, a status symbol.
Yeah. Tell us about the incident where you went to the home of one of your owner's parents, and there, when the servants saw you beaten by Rahab, one of them defended you.
Yeah, Rahab, she's, yeah, I went with her to her, somewhere with her, and she's so cruel to me. One of the servants there, she's really lovely. Her name is Karia. She really divine to me. She's really spoke to her. She said, "Why you treat her like that?" And when the child is fall over, she said, "It's not her fault. She's looking for the children. There's nothing wrong here." She really get across with her, and even she left her job because of me.
Yeah. And Damien, it seems that this is one of the few times in this period of Mende's life where she's treated as a human being.
Yeah, there were really only two times in the 7 years that she was held in Khartoum as a slave in that woman's house. There were only two times when she's treated with anything like a modicum of humanity. One of those is, as you say, when she goes to visit her master's mother, and her master's mother has servants who are paid, as opposed to Mende, who was a slave bought and captured. And one of those servants tries to defend Mende because she sees Mende's master beating her. And Mende's a small girl still, she's about 14. And this older servant says to Mende, "Look, you know, your master's not allowed to beat you like that. She's not allowed to insult you in the way she does." And Mende's master overhears this, and there's a huge showdown in the household. And the servant resigns because she's so disgusted by what's happening. And in the second incident, Mende's master, a little later in Mende's incarceration in Khartoum, gets very angry with her for no reason, really, and throws her down onto a piece of metal furniture and slices Mende's leg open from the thigh down to her knee, and obviously severs an artery, and has to rush Mende to hospital, who's unconscious. And when Mende's in the hospital, the nurse there, one of the black nurses, detects that something's not right here and tries to get Mende to confide in her and tell her what's really going on. But her master has already said to Mende, "If you tell any of the nurses what's, you know, your real situation, basically we'll kill you." Mm. And so Mende's too scared. She's terrified.
Yeah, I'm really terrified of her. I'm really terrified, of her for beating or abusing me.
When did you learn you were to be sent to London from Khartoum?
When she told me that before a few days, he told me, he said, "Mende, come." The bit he called me, he doesn't use my name. And I went over to her, and she said to me, "Look, I want to send you London to my sister." And she already gave me all the instructions, what I should do, what I shouldn't. And she told me everything, how can I behave to obey my new master. And then from there, I realized I'm going to move from her house to somewhere else.
Yeah. Did you know anything about London?
No, at all. I don't know at all. So, London or so, we don't know about. We only know foreign countries called. What's the right word?
All really that. You know, people from the Nuba Mountain knew they had a concept of somewhere outside of the Nuba Mountains, which they called Bilabara.
Which
means in Arabic somewhere far away.
Yeah.
So, as far as Mende understood, London was just Bilabara, somewhere far away.
Yeah.
That's all I know.
And before London, Khartoum was a long way away, too.
Yeah, Khartoum is a long way away, but we don't know Khartoum. Is Khartoum like, but finally I found out Khartoum is exactly in Sudan. Sudan is not a foreign country.
Right. Yours was a very happy childhood, and this is where the book begins, after the prologue. Damien, were you surprised at how the book opened after you got together with Mende and the two of you, you know, wrote the story out? And were you surprised that this was how the book would open?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, as a journalist, I knew the horror of Mende's story. Mm. I knew nothing about her childhood. I'd been to the Nuba Mountains before, so I knew something about, you know, the culture there. But when we sat down to write the book, I said, "Well, you know, we should start at the beginning. So tell me about your first memories." And then, lo and behold, we spent the next month literally talking about this wonderful, rich culture and childhood and the beautiful relationship she had with her father, and, you know, the way the family interrelated with the tribe. And I kept saying to her, you know, because Mende could remember things in almost photographic detail, you know, conversations around the fire, journeys with her father on the donkey to the fields. And I kept saying, you know, how do you remember this stuff? Because, you know, my memories of my childhood are pretty sketchy, to say this, at best. And, you know, slowly we realized it's because the Nuba are an oral culture. There's no TV, there's no electricity, there's no phones, there's nothing of that nature. And so, and they don't write anything down, they don't keep diaries or anything. And so they keep retelling to each other the stories of the tribe and the family and what's been happening in their lives. And that's how she managed to remember it all so vividly. So the first third of the book, which is about this wonderful childhood, which I think we can all relate to as well, because there are, you know, parts of it are exotic and feel far away, but there are many parts of it which just ring true to us. You know, family relationships, the way they looked after their pet cat, Mende's relationship with her cat. These things speak to us about, you know, with a familiarity. And that gives an added richness to the story. And indeed, when she's taken away and in the brutal raid that happens on her village, it makes it all the more hard to deal with because she's had such a lovely childhood beforehand.
Yeah. There were a couple of games that you mentioned in the book, Mende, that are not unlike games that I played as a girl. One where you throw up a rock and then you try and pick up some pebbles before the rock comes crashing down. That's very much like a game of what we call jacks. Let's go back to the idea of storytelling. Mende, after the evening meal, your father would tell stories. What kind of stories did he tell?
He tell us different stories, many different stories. He told us many different stories. It's like a story about the sky. The sky used to be so close, and a woman, he cooking some kind of food, and he always bent, and he trying to touch the sky, and the sky, he flew away, and seeing that the sky is become far away, is untouching, you can't touch it again. This sort of stories.
Yeah. Damien, do you have a favorite story that Mende told you about her father's stories?
Yeah, I think the one that sticks in my mind is in the forest around their village. I mean, you know, they were surrounded by forests and mountains, and they would hunt animals, you know, to eat, and they would never kill the hairy black monkeys in the forest. And one day, Mende said to her father, "You know, why don't we hunt the monkeys?" And her father told her a story, and the story was that all human beings on Earth who had been bad, when they died, they were turned into hairy black monkeys as their in a sort of form of punishment. And so, if they had killed and eaten the black monkeys, they would actually be killing human beings, in effect.
Yeah.
So that's why they didn't. Do you remember that story, Mende?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Naughty monkeys. Would you tell us the story, Mende, of the day you went with your father? Damien mentioned this a moment or two ago. You went with your father to protect the fields from birds.
Yeah.
Oh, tell us that story, please.
Yeah, actually, that day my dad, he told me a few days before, he told me, "I'm going to take you to the field with me, and you're going to look after the birds, and then I come back home. On some occasion, and I come back to the falls." I agree. I'm so happy. I'm jumping and telling my friends, like, "Oh, I'm going to the field with my dad," and really teasing them. And they said, "Okay, Mende, if you go to the falls, who's going to play with you?" I said, "No, I'm not going to play with anybody. I'm going to look after the bed, so I don't need anybody to play it with." And I'm so happy. As that day, we went to the field, and it started raining, and all the Bed River are full of water, and we're carrying all our flowers and food on a donkey. And me and my dad, we ride on a donkey. But when we came in this river, it's so full of water, we can't cross. But my dad, he said, how are we going to cross here? And it's really long story. It's very long story. My my dad, he took me and he went across. He holding me in my shoulder. He carrying me in his shoulder. And I'm causing a lot of trouble. I said, why don't you catch me with your both hands? You want me to fall on a river and die? I'm causing a lot of trouble. And I know how he's going to hold me. He's holding a stick to prevent himself of love, of feeling on water. He said, Mindy, if I hold you both my hand, how am I going to manage to walk in this water? And then I crossed, he crossed me finally, and later he came back to took his the monkey. The donkey. I'm loving the donkey. Don't want to get into the water, and everything is over. I'm loving my dad. He goes, Mindy, do you think it's something funny here? I'm just loving. Long story.
Yeah, and in the end, you were a handful that day. You were some more trouble than you were help in the fields.
But a lot of trouble. I know he told me that he's going to take me to the field, and later he will come back home. The day he's coming back home, I really caused a lot of trouble. Like, I don't want to stay in the field. I don't care about the bed in the field. I don't care. I want to go home. Yeah. I'm just causing a lot of trouble. And my dad, he said, he tried to convince me, but I don't want to hear what he's saying. He said, okay, then I'm going. Mindy, he took long time to convince me. Later, my dad, he gets onto the monkey. I just running behind the monkey.
Donkey.
And I don't want to stay. My daddy said, Mindy, you should go back. I just, I run. I don't want. My dad, he said, okay. He took me on a donkey, and we came back again to the field.
Yeah.
It's a long story, and it's not finished yet. You want me to carry on?
Well, to sum up here, the idea was that you would watch the fields. The seeds had been planted, newly planted. And your job was to keep the birds away.
Yeah.
And you were a lot of trouble for your father that day. But in the end, he laughed about it with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He left me at the end, and I really across, and after he gone, I don't have nothing to do. I look after the animals, and I want to be sure the bird is not coming in the field, but. Later, while I'm watching, I saw fox, is some bird there, and while I'm watching this bird, I saw suddenly something moving in a forest, and come and I said, what's that? I found out it's a fox. I climb on the tree. We are a very good climber, actually, in the Nuba Mountains. All the children, we climb over the tree, and we pick our fruit. I climb on a tree. I just watching, and later this fox it cuts the bird and run away. When the animal is gone, I jump on from the tree and I run to my uncle Hamada's field. I'm shaking. I'm crying, and I didn't go back to the field. And my dad he didn't come back at that day. He said he's coming back. He took 2 days to come back.
Mm.
And when he came, I'm really across with him. When the day he came, I said, like, I don't want to greet him. I don't want to say hello to him. I said, and I took my hand. I said, like, I'm injured by the animals' attack or goats. I don't want to tell him anything. I said, you left me here. I almost died. And look, and come and see. I saw him. I saw, look, the blood here. My dad, he said, he's laughing. He said, Mindy, are you back? You know, this is a bear because the feather is there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very long story.
Yeah. It's a good story. Mende Nazir and Damian Lewis are our guests this afternoon. The two are the authors of a book about the years Mende was enslaved. The title of the book is Slave, My True Story. If you're just joining us this afternoon, listeners, let me sum up the story here. Mende Nazaire and her family lived in a remote area of Sudan. They lived in the Nupa Mountains in south central Sudan. The people of her village were hunters and farmers. They raised cattle. Most of the people were Muslims. And one night in the spring of 1994, the village where she and her family lived was raided. The village was burned. Many people were killed. The children were rounded up and taken away, sold into slavery. You can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Damian Lewis, you've done a lot of reporting on Sudan. How common are these raids?
Well, unfortunately, they're very, very common. The war in Sudan is Africa's longest-running civil war, and its simplest, it pits a black African south of the country against an Arabic-dominated north of the country. And the raiders are from the Arabic north, and they ride into the south on horseback with swords and Kalashnikov automatic rifles, and they basically set alight to villages, kill the adult males and the old people, and capture the women and children as slaves, and also round up the cattle and drive those away as the booty of war. And reports by many, many organizations, including the U.S. State Department Bureau of African Affairs, put the number of slaves in Sudan at somewhere, certainly tens of thousands, possibly over 100,000. So we're talking about a very large number of people and raids which have been extensive and ongoing for many years.
Yeah. What effect does such a murderous raid have on a village? Is the village destroyed?
The effect is too horrific to put into words. I've actually been into some of these places the day after the raiders have been through, and it's a scene from hell. Sometimes the villagers come back and try and rebuild their lives, but part and parcel of the reason for the raids is to try and dispossess the people of the land. And so in many situations, once a village has been raided two or three times, the people never return. There are 6 million refugees who have left Sudan and gone into refugee camps or come to America and Britain. So, you're talking about a mass exodus of people from a ravaged area.
Has anyone pressured the Sudanese government on this issue?
There's been a lot of pressure over many years. Many journalists have been there, lots of humanitarian and human rights organizations and government. The U.S. government puts pressure on the Sudanese regime, and in fact the U.S. government is perhaps the leading government to put pressure on the Sudanese regime. And the issue of slavery is one of the most emotive in terms of why people criticize the regime. But it's a massive, intractable problem. It's hard to put into words, but you have an ingrained and endemic racism affected by the Arab peoples of the north, and of course not all of them. One cannot stereotype, but generally speaking, there's a racism from the Arabs of the north against the black Africans of the south, which is that those people in the south, the black Africans, are no better than animals and should be treated as such. And, in Mende's story, you can see that treatment being affected. You can see what actually happened.
Mm.
And until you change that attitude, rather like, when we British and you guys were the masters of slavery 200, 300 years ago, until you change the attitude that lies behind it, the belief that one race of people is inferior to another race of people, where does the solution lie? It's hard to see.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on a cell phone on line one. Let's go and talk with this listener. Good afternoon.
Hi. My question was, why don't we hear more about this racism and slavery? I've heard a little in the past, but why doesn't someone keep hammering it home until something gets done? I'll listen, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Why do we not hear more about it?
Yeah.
Well, I wish we did. I've been to Sudan 40, 50 times, at least over the last 10 years, to report on it. But we're talking about Africa. We're talking about somewhere very far away. We're not talking about a war between two countries. We're talking about a civil war. And I think it's hard for Brit Britain, America, the West, it makes it harder to criticize when you have religion thrown into the equation, and you are talking about an Islamic North against a Christian animist or moderate Muslim South. And in a way, I think that makes it more difficult for us to criticize. But we are talking about, in Sudan, you know, the only country in the world today where you have modern-day chattel slavery, people seized in raids, the families killed, the village burnt down, and then sold into slavery. That's going on today, as we speak, 21st century. So You're absolutely right. It needs to be exposed more, and you know, exposure is the only thing that will lead to change.
Yeah. In the book's acknowledgments, Mende thanks a number of journalists, although one story endangered her situation. But overall, she says if her story had not been publicized, she probably would have been sent back to Sudan.
Yes, in an extremely embarrassing twist of the story, embarrassing for the British government. Of course, when Mende escaped, she had no idea what she was going to do. She escaped in London. She thought she would just somehow earn some money and travel back home and go back to the Nuba Mountains and see her family, which is her dream. But instead, we had to say, you know, look, I'm afraid you can't do that. You're going to have to claim asylum. And so she filed an asylum claim in the UK. And 2 years after filing that claim, in a move which confounded everybody, the British government refused her asylum, and she was under threat of deportation back to the regime that had enslaved her. It was completely bizarre. You know, very quickly they were forced to change their mind. Within a month they had withdrawn their decision and then granted her asylum. But that really only happened because of the enormous pressure brought to bear by journalists and campaigners and human rights organizations and politicians, you know, the world over, who knew about Mende's story and could see that this was an injustice, a massive injustice. But you're absolutely right. You know, it was that pressure which helped save her from that awful, awful, unspeakable, unthinkable fate of her being sent back where she came from.
Are there others who managed to free themselves only to find themselves, you know, not in a situation much better than they're getting out of?
Well, an awful lot of people ask, you know, say to Mende, why did you not run away? I mean, you know, we think of slavery being physical constraints. We think of it being chains, people being chained or tied up or put behind fences. And one of the things which I realized when writing the book on Mende's behalf with her was that she was enslaved psychologically. Her master in Khartoum destroyed any sense that she had of her rights as a human being, even of her existence as a human being. So any sense of self-worth, any ability to make your own decisions, all those things were destroyed and taken away from her. And when you do that to people, it makes it extremely difficult for them even to take the decision to escape, to do something for themselves. And even when they contemplate escaping, even if they think about it, where can they run to in Sudan? You know, imagine Mende, she's in Khartoum, she's surrounded by Arabs. No one's going to help her. No one is going to help that girl when she escapes. It's far more likely that someone else is going to take her and rape her or take her to be a slave in their house. So how do these people get away? It's almost impossible. And if they do get away, where are they going to go? Back to their village, which is being raided? To the refugee camps, which are pretty much hell on earth? So yeah, you're absolutely right. The options are very limited. And in a bizarre way, you know, Mende's journey to London was what gave her the chance to escape and be free. If she hadn't done that, she'd still be a slave.
Yeah.
In London, Mende, how was it that you began thinking about freedom? And maybe you would tell us about those people who helped you.
Actually, I get my chance when my mother, she decided to go back Sudan. They took me to his to my mother's colleague house, and they were really nice people. I stayed with them while they were in Sudan, something like a month. The people I've been with them, they're really nice people. They're so friendly, and that's the first time I feel like a human being. And I eat in the same place with them, and I have a chat with them, and. And they took me out to the park and to the shop. I know my way around. And they allow me to go out to just have a fresh air and come back. Yeah, I get my chance from there. One day, they asked me what sort of job I did and what kind of how much money I earn or what sort of job I did. And I really surprised. I said, how many hours I work? I work every minute, every day, very hard. I have to work, and I have to do everything. And there, this man, he told me, Mindy, you have right to earn money and to do whatever you want to. He told me that he like opened my mind. I start to think about how can I escape.
Yeah. Damien, tell us about the people that eventually would help Mende.
Well, there is a Nuba community, a community from the Nuba Mountains in Sudan, which is where Mende's from, in London. These are people who have come into exile as refugees. There are Nuba communities in the U.S. as well. And one of these people found out that Mende's was being held in this house in London, found out where that house was, and prepared to rescue her, made contact with her and prepared to rescue her because that's what she wanted. She was desperate. And I first became aware of this because I actually knew this person from having worked on Sudanese stories before, and he contacted me and said, look, there's this girl, she's being held in this house, we're going to try and rescue her, will you help us, plan the rescue and be there the day she escapes? And I said, yeah, sure. And to me, it wasn't, to most people, I guess it would have seemed inconceivable that there was a girl being held in London against her will in these conditions. But because I had, worked in Sudan over many years and filmed the story of slavery there so many times and seen the results of the raids and seen Arab slave traders and talked to them and interviewed them, because of all of that, I knew that it was very likely true, and the story rang true to me. And so, these people organized for Mende's rescue and then managed to get her out of that house and get her into freedom.
Hmm. Long struggle, though. I mean, she gets out of that house in the year 2000, and just last year, 2003, she was granted asylum.
Yeah, she... she's on a journey, really, a journey from, it's almost like a journey from death back to life,
yeah.
Really is what it amounts to. I mean, she was 12, she was captured, life stopped then. She was a child and her life stopped, and it's only just begun again a few years ago. She has no education, she's learning English, she's had 2 years English lessons and she's doing remarkably well, but just imagine if your life had stopped when you were 12. Just imagine all the things you would not have learned to do that a normal adolescent, young adult learns to do, and all those things she's having to learn to do again. So she's on a very long journey, and she's got an awful lot to recover from. It's taken her a long time to learn to trust people, that people can be your friend.
Yeah.
Imagine not having had a conversation with another human being for 7 years. Imagine what that's like. That was the situation she was in. All she ever had was orders barked at her, or she was beaten. So imagine not having had a conversation for 7 years and having to learn to have a conversation again with someone. It's hard to put into words what the challenges before her. So she's on a long journey, and I think it will take a long time for her to reach the stage where she feels as if she is truly free. I mean, she talks about freedom in the book as being the most wonderful mm-hmm. thing that's ever happened to her,
yes.
But also that it's terrifying. Freedom is terrifying in itself. You have responsibility. You have to make decisions. You have to
be independent.
You have to be independent. So, and you've spent 7 years having every single thing you do in your life ordered to you, what you wear, what time you get up, when you go to bed, what you do during the day. Imagine the change, and imagine what you then have to come to terms with in your life.
Mende, this is the question that Damien asked you, and I'd like to ask you the same question this afternoon. What would you say to the people who enslaved you?
I really don't know a specific word to say, because I feel a lot of things I want to say to them. I really want to say to them, look, it is not that different between you and me and between white and black. And I think God created everybody in the world. We're all the same as a human being. And they should respect each other. They shouldn't enslave other people because they are poor or because of their color. I want them to know it's not different, and it's not that something is really Quran, my religion, advice to people to say you should insult each other. I want them to know they are not better than me. All the people in the world, whether it's black or white, whether it's foreign, they're all the same.
Hmm. Damien, what do you hope people hearing this story, people reading this book, will take from it?
Well, I guess one part of me hopes that people will be uplifted. It's a strange thing, but in the UK and elsewhere where the book's been published, we've been asked to sign books, for example, and when you sign a book, you want to write something for the person you're signing it for, something that will mean something to them. And you can never write, I hope you enjoy reading this, because, it's such a searing account of something which is so hard to believe. I hope it doesn't leave people just angry. I hope it leaves people uplifted, because although it's an account of something unbelievably, unspeakably terrible, that was done to one human being, she endures. She keeps her hope. She keeps her faith in the fact that she will be free, and she does escape. So, in a sense, it's a story of redemption as much as anything else. So I hope people take away from it, a feeling of a hope and positiveness, and I hope that will inspire people to try and help end the existence of slavery, because it will make them feel they want to do something.
Yeah. Mende, when you were a girl in school, you studied hard, because your dream was to be a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your dream today?
Today I'm just studying to improve my English. Yes, I've been dreaming want to be a doctor, but I think it's quite hard for me to become a doctor because of the language. I don't think I can.
Yeah.
It's not that easy for me, but I'm really studying very hard first to improve my English, and later in the future I'm thinking I want to be a nurse.
A nurse.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, again, I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon. Damien, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Damien Lewis and Mende Nazaire have been our guests this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Together, they are the authors of Slave, My True Story. The book is published by Public Affairs Books. It's 11 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Settlement prices are in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures, as our own Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey, told me just a moment ago, we're acting kind of tired at the Board of Trade this afternoon and throughout the day. They finished that way as well, lower across the floor in the grain and oil seeds. Let's start with the March wheat for the coarse grains, 391.5 on the high for the day, the low at 384.5, a settlement price at 386.75. They were down a penny and 3/4 of the day. The May wheat at 397 high, low at 390.5, a settlement price at 393.25. That down for the day, a penny and a quarter. July contract for the wheat pit, 387.75. The high, the low at 383, and a settlement at 384, down one. September futures in the wheat pit, 390.5. The high, the low at 386.5. A settlement price at 387. They were down one as well. And the December contract, 0.75% lower for the day at 394.5. Settlement price, their high, 397.5. A low in the wheat for December contract, 393.5. Now, the corn pit, March futures, 285.25 to the high, the low at 279.5, a settlement price off 3 cents at 281.25. May contract for the corn, 291.75 high, low at 285.25, and a settlement price at 287.75. They finished down three as well. July futures, 293.5, the high, the low at 288. A settlement price at 298.25, down 2.75 in September, 287.5 high and low at 282. A settlement price at 284.5, down 2.5 cents. December corn futures 284.5, the high, the low at 278.5, a settlement price at 282, and they finished down a penny and 3/4 for the day. March contract 286.5, high, low at 281, a settlement at 285, down a penny and 3/4. July futures for the corn pit 289, the high, the low at 284, a settlement price at 286, down 3, and December contract 405 in the corn pit 258.5, the high, the low at 257.75, a settlement price at 258. That was down 1 for the day. I almost transposed those numbers and made somebody very happy. March oats day, 154 the high, the low at 150.25, a settlement price at 150.5. They were down 2.25. And the May oats at 159, a settlement price at on the high side, and the low at 155.25, a settlement at 155.5, and they were down 2 for the day. From the soy complex now, futures finished like this in the bean pit, anywhere between 5 cents lower in the far deferreds and 16 cents lower in the nearby March contract. 838 the high, the low at 810 in the March, a settlement at 822, they were down 16 cents. May contract for the soybeans, 839 the high, the low at 812, settlement price 823, down 15.5 cents. In July soybean futures, 821 the high, the low at 801, settlement price at 808.75, down 12.25. September contract 729.5, the high, the low at 720, a settlement price at 720, down 9 cents. That's September looking a lot more like the new crop than the old crop at this point. And of course, it's always a transitional month. Speaking of the old crop, the November now, or the new crop now, the 656.5 in the November, so on the high, the low at 647.25, settlement price at 649. They were down 5.75 in the January bean. 657 the high, the low at 650, settlement price at 650, down 6 cents. And the March soybean, 659.5 high, low at 655, settlement price 655. They were down a nickel. March bean meal at 247.50, the high, the low at 241.50, settlement price at 243.10, down 4.90. And the May meal, 247.50, the high, the low at 241.20, a settlement price at 243. And that finished the day 5 lower for the day. March bean oil, 32.35 the high, the low at 31.58, a settlement price at 31.68, and down 46 for the day. And the May bean oil, 32.28 on the high, the low at 31.55, a settlement at 31.69, down 42. Hey, stay with us through the 2 o'clock hour this afternoon when we'll have the closing market report. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker. I haven't spoken personally with Dan for a couple of weeks now. Last time we talked a great deal, probably at length, to remember about this, technically how the markets look to him, that they might be on their way down. Of course, we had a lot of things happen between then and now, and we'll have to take a look and see where he says they are technically. That'll all happen at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon, during the closing market report, when we talk with Dan Zwicker. Right now, from the Mercantile Exchange with the numbers, here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. A mostly lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, 83.70 the high, 81.85 the low, 82.85 the settlement, that up 10. April, 84.80 the high, 82.70 the low, 83.57.5 the settlement, that down 52.5. May, 85.85 the high, 84.10 the low, 84.82.5 the settlement, that down 27.5. August feeder cattle, 88.55 the high, 87.10 the low, 87.77.5 the settlement, that down 37.5. February live cattle, 76.60 the high, 75.50 the low, 76.05 the settlement, that up 95. March, 75.70 the high, 74.10 the low, 74.10 the settlement, that down 10. April, 73.90 the high, 72.25 the low, 72.50 the settlement, that down 35. June, 70.80 the high, 69.75 the low, 70.05 the settlement, that down 10. February lean hog, 63.80 the high, 63.35 the low, 63.75 the settlement, that up 37.5. April, 60.12.5 the high, 58.17.5 the low, the settlement 58.37.5, that down 180. May lean hog, 60.70 the high, 58.95 the low, the settlement 59.67.5, that down 105. June lean hog, 65.05 the high, 63.10 the low, 64.10 the settlement, that down 70. February pork bellies, 93.50 the high, 91.95 the low, 92.75 the settlement, that down 95. And March pork bellies, 94.50 the high, 92.65 the low, 93.20 the settlement, that down 125. The Dow currently down 38 points at 10,699. The NASDAQ is off 12 points at 2,078. The S&P 500 off 5 at 1153.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up tonight on our companion station, WILL-TV, at 7 o'clock, it's Illinois Gardener. Viewer questions are welcome as host Diane Noland and a panel of experts discuss gardening, landscaping, and lawn care. That's Illinois Gardener at 7. Later tonight on Channel 12, WILL-TV, Frontline at 9 o'clock. Tonight, Beyond Baghdad. Correspondent Martin Smith travels across the Iraqi-Turkish border, across the rebellious Sunni lands of central Iraq and further south to Iraq's sacred Shia cities. That's tonight on Frontline at 9 o'clock, Beyond Baghdad. Frontline tonight on WILL-TV.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont; Thrifty Nickel, Champaign; and GCOM Incorporated in Savoy. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dean Cully from San Luis Obispo, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, how does dogmatism compare with catechism?"
The terms were developed back in 200 A.D., when a group of religious zealots, the rudimentarians, prepared two different forms of gospels, one to convert dogs, the other cats. This was a time of great diversity in religious practice, including the Stylites, who were the original flagpole sitters, and the Ornitharians, who tarred and feathered themselves, slept in nests, and spent the last years of their lives entombed in plaster of Paris eggs. The division between the scriptures vanished with the King James translation.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. To order the Duck's Breath CD pack, including Dr. Science's new Get Smart disc, the new Best of Duck's Breath collection, and the new Ian Scholes compilation, I Gotta Go, three CDs for $32.95 postpaid, call 800-989-3825.
Eric Severide charmed audiences with his insight and dry wit on the TV evening news.
Now, with the highly developed arts of mass communication and mass transportation, we can misunderstand each other faster and more deeply than ever before.
Walter Cronkite remembers Murrow Boy and eloquent...